Good afternoon. We're back here for hour number two on this Thursday, January the 10th, 2019. About said 18 there, 15 minutes past the hour. You're tuned into the Now program here on WWGH Radio 107.1 FM. And I do want to remind people, our website, you can listen to any program that's been on this station since January of 2016. Adam Lepp, our webmaster, does a tremendous job with that. Just go to WWGH1071.com. And if you want to listen to us on any mobile device live, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, download the free TuneIn app. You can get that on any mobile device. It's absolutely free, won't cost you a penny. Search WWGH and you can listen live anywhere on any mobile device. Our guest this hour, it's always a pleasure to welcome him to these microphones, the mayor of the city of Marion, Scott Schertzer. Mayor Schertzer, how are you?
I'm doing great. Thank you for having me on. You know, you mentioned almost saying the wrong year. Do you remember when we used to write checks?
Oh, yes.
Which we don't do very much anymore because of debit cards. And January was always tough because you're always writing the previous year until you reprogram your brain. So
there used to be a class in school to teach you how to write a check.
You are right. And I don't know that they don't have that anymore, but I wouldn't be surprised if many school districts do not have, we used to call it life skills when I was in high school, the very basic things, how to manage a checkbook, how to manage certain things in life as a young teen adult that's going to be stepping into the adult world in a very short few months or even years. So that is something that we don't teach anymore. I think they leave it up to the parents to teach it.
What do you make of all the technology? I think about it every day. Facebook, internet, smartphones, text messaging. You have young kids. What do you make of it all?
Mind-boggling is the first thing that comes to my mind. You know, the access to information instantaneously is just unreal, and could never have imagined that when I was my children's age growing up in the 80s. We've come a long way. I always tell my children that, you know, they have tools available to them that I never did and their mother never did. But you need to use that new technology for good and not evil. And I think that there's maybe where we should have the class in the schools today on how to properly use social media and the technology, because we see too often people using it for evil. We have evil people across this world who prey on senior citizens to get information from them, to get into their checking accounts and their Medicaid or Medicaid or whatever, you name it. So we all have to be careful, and I don't think a lot of folks know exactly how to protect themselves against the evils of the technology that we live with today and social media.
Interesting. The last time you were here was Election Day.
Okay.
Election Day 2018, Mary Ellen Withrow, Governor Strickland, and Ted Williams was here. Satch Solinger was here. What'd you make of the way that election turned out?
Well, let me just say that the panel that you had on that day, I think every one of us were wrong.
I think so. I think how did we all miss it?
I don't think any of us had our fingers on the pulse of the state. We may have been looking at our community. We may have been speaking more from the heart than we were anything. And you can't do that in situations like a statewide or even a national election. I remember one national election I was on the radio with you, and we thought that whomever, I don't remember, was going to win Florida. Maybe it was Hillary Clinton at the time. Well, it turned out she didn't. You know, so sitting here in your studios, it's more of an opinion and not a fact. It's more of a heartfelt feeling and not a fact. Oftentimes, when we deal with issues like that, it's almost like saying, who's going to win the Ohio State-Michigan football game? I'm going to tell you Ohio State every single time. But we both know, statistically speaking, there will be that day that will come that team up north will ultimately beat our beloved Buckeyes. But we hope not, and we make predictions like that often from the heart.
The interesting thing to me, though, is covering many elections at this point, prior to 2016, you used to have a handle. You thought there were might have been a few, maybe local races that went some different way than what you might have thought. But now, president, governor, local races, the margins are bigger. DeWine and Cordray, everybody I do think that day thought Cordray was going to win. DeWine ends up winning and winning by 3 points. Mm-hmm. It's way off from what we think it's going to be. And I don't know what has caused that in the last 3 years.
Well, and I think social scientists and political scientists are trying to answer those questions. You always do a kind of a post-mortem after elections like that, whether it's presidential or gubernatorial, and find out why. Where did we go wrong? Where were our numbers wrong? And, you know, we live here in Marion, as your listeners know and you know. It's a rural community, and the county seat is the biggest metropolitan in our county. But we're still a very rural, agricultural-based community. And we're not Franklin County, Cuyahoga County, and some of the other metropolitan areas. And if you look at some of those counties I just mentioned, they probably did go for Cordray. And they did not go for DeWine. So you can see that the Democrats are having a challenge in reaching out into the ruralized agricultural-based communities and identifying with voters. And there's an area where I believe that my party needs to pay special attention, because you can't get shellacked in those rural counties and make up for it in the metropolitan areas like you used to do in the 80s and the 90s or even maybe the 70s. So it's a different kind of politics. And we're a much more divided society today when it comes to political issues. You take the top political topic going on in the country right now. I've talked to friends that are staunchly one way and others that are staunchly the other. And I guess I try and find the happy middle ground as a policymaker and say, well, you know, look at this. Is this really going to work, or should we do that? And people get so dug in that they're not willing to listen. You know, I think that's where Stephen Covey's 7 Habits of Highly Effective Learning come in. And I'll paraphrase, and I don't remember the number, but you have to seek to understand to first be understood. And when you are unable to understand the other side, you're going to dig in your heels and say, there's no way I'm compromising. And everybody looks at an issue as a deeply personal, don't ask me to violate my values. Not all public policy decisions are value-based positions. Yes, many of them are, but they're not all those types of values.
It's very interesting when we talk about Marion County, and I want to get to the budget after this question, but in the last 3 years, I believe, I may be wrong on this, but Sheriff Bailey won as a Democrat in 2016. I think he was the only Democrat that won that year. 2017, council went Republican, and I think the only Democrats who won aside from at-large or unopposed, I don't think any won who were not unopposed. And last year, no Democrats won in Marion County. What does that say to you? That's a long time since something like that's happened.
Well, what it says to me as the mayor is the voters like to know who you are. And especially when it comes to those local elections, they like to be able to say, yeah, I've met the mayor and he's an okay guy. I might not agree with him on everything, but I like him and I know him. And that's very important in local elections. You're not going to get that in congressional, national elections, statewide elections, because most of us don't have the opportunity to get to personally know the candidates. And then most people fall back on either party lines or philosophical beliefs that they have that a party that they believe a party supports or does not support in that issue.
This week, the big news was the line item veto. What take us through this whole situation? What is a line item veto, first of all, for people who don't know?
Well, first of all, I guess you say the big news is, I thought the big news was coming out of Washington, but maybe locally, on our level. The bigger news was. So, yeah, and thank you for starting it off with that, because most people don't know what a veto is. Let alone that there are 3 different types of vetoes that the executive branch has at their disposal. Now, a veto is a part of the checks and balances system that we have. Let's go back to 12th grade government, and at least that's when I had government in 12th grade. I don't think they exclusively teach it as a senior anymore, but let's go back to high school government. You have to understand the three branches of government: legislative, executive, and judicial. And then you have to understand the responsibilities of each of those three branches. What do they do? What are they responsible for? And then to ensure that not one branch becomes more powerful than the other, they have the ability to check one another, to keep that power of imbalance, so to speak. And one of them that the executive branch has is the veto power. And I can veto a, we'll use the word bill in the case of city council, it's an ordinance, but to keep the term simple, to veto a bill would be to say, you know, I don't agree with this bill, so I'm vetoing it. I'm canceling it out. And then in the case of a veto, the legislative body has an opportunity to check the power of the veto from the executive branch, i.e. the mayor, the governor, the president. And they can override a veto. And so that's your basic veto. And then there are two other kinds of vetoes that are rarely talked about. And that's a pocket veto, which I have used numerous times. And that's just where I choose not to put my signature on it. It sits a little bit longer in the queue, so to speak, before it can go into effect. And that may be something like, you know, I just don't agree with this. I'm not going to veto it. I'm not going to ask council to or give them the opportunity to override. I'll let it become law, but I'm just not going to let it become law with my signature because there's a philosophical belief that I don't like it for whatever reason. And then there's the line item veto. And I will be clear with you that mayors and governors often have this power. The president does not have the power to line item veto. And that's where you take something specific in a bill, as opposed to vetoing the whole thing, and you just take the part that you don't like and you line item veto that portion of that bill, and the rest of it goes into effect in the normal procedures that it would. And there again, with a line item veto, it can be overridden by the legislative body as well. In this case, it was not. A special council meeting would have had to have been convened by council to take up one sole item, which is the mayor's line item veto, to override. And they needed 6 votes to override the line item veto. And nobody chose to do that. And really what that tells me is that the 9 voting members of council agreed with me on this particular line item veto.
What happened? Because it's the Marion Municipal Court budget. Is that correct?
Well, it's the city's budget.
City's budget.
And they are a part of the city's budget.
Right. So it's my understanding from what I've read, and correct me if I'm wrong here, that a budget was put together in September, and then it was passed on the 20th, and then before you signed off on it, you vetoed the budget by $100,000. Is that correct?
That's pretty darn close, I'll tell you that. So let's nail down the timeline a little more securely here. Every department head and every elected official that is a part of the city budget does a preliminary budget, I want to say, in June. So that's when we kind of get our first glimpse, but we're still a long way from passing a budget. And that also, that preliminary budget has to be passed and given over to the county because the county is a part of getting certain types of revenues made available to the city government. So that's more of a procedural process. And then you get into the fall, and then the department heads start to, we'll use the term, pencil whip their budget more, get it more in line with what their true needs and wants are in their budget. So that happens in, I'm going to say, I can't speak for every department head or every elected official, but I'm going to say about October. And then those budgets from all those departments and all those elected officials are channeled into the auditor's office, where the entire budget is kind of compiled into one document, which will be one ordinance that will ultimately go before city council. But during that time before it goes to city council, you know, we're talking to department heads and elected officials about certain items, line items in their budgets. And the safety director did have a discussion with the clerk of courts and the head probation officer, and their increase request from the general fund was a triple digit increase. So that was the first time that we saw such an enormous increase. And never in my 10-year as in municipal government have I seen a triple-digit increase, unless we knew that we were getting a grant, which would precipitate and cause an increase like that. There were no new expected revenues to come in. In fact, the auditor said that our revenues would remain flat. When we get that kind of forecast from our auditor, who manages and watches the deposits coming in and out and the expenditures, we tell our department heads, budget for what you had last year, and then whatever needs you think you have, then let's sit down with either the safety director, the service director, or the public works director. Each one of those directors are responsible for other departments underneath them. And the safety director, one of his responsibilities is the court budget. The service director would be responsible for, say, parks, the senior center, other departments, and likewise with the director of public works, the street department, the sanitation department, the sewer department, just to give you an example. And in nowhere did we see a triple digit increase. And so the safety director did his job. He called the members of the court of common or a municipal court, the clerk, and that's normally who we would deal with in a situation like this. So we didn't violate normal protocol. And he sat down with them and said, wow, this triple digit increase is rather large. And so they cut it down. He did his job. Great. So then the budget continues to move forward. And it goes, and it actually, this budget went before council committee on 11/20. And it was voted out of committee, I believe, on 11/20, November 20th.
Now, what was the dollar amount for the municipal court then?
I believe it was $177,000.
Okay.
And so we had our first reading on 11/26, the second reading on 12/10, and then the third reading and the vote was on 12/20. So everything happened within a month's time, from the time it went to committee to the time it was voted on. And part of the reason for the short timeline was really because of when Christmas Day came and when New Year's Day came. So council called a special meeting on December 20th, which is a Thursday night. We don't normally meet on Thursday nights unless we have to. And in this case, we had to. So once it got into the first reading, that's when I realized that the particular line item of $177,000 was still a triple-digit increase. And then the safety director and I discussed it, and he said, well, we got him to bring it down from, I'll tell you right here, their initial request was $237,552, and we got him down to, he got him down to $177,000. And I still felt that a triple-digit increase was something that we couldn't sustain in a budget where our revenues were flat at best. And when I say flat at best, that means we're looking to generate the same amount of revenue in 19 that we did in 18. So when I saw that, we had already had our first reading. And then, you know, council looks at the budget and they questioned a couple things in the budget from another elected official, by the way. And they decided in the first reading to take away $20,000 from another elected official out of the budget. And then we went on to the second reading, which was December the 10th. And it was really probably close to around that time, maybe after the first reading, maybe after the second. I really don't know. I didn't make a mental note or a physical note of it. But that's when I recognized the still triple-digit increase where the court was requesting from the general fund. Okay, we call that a transfer outline item. That means money transfers out of the general fund revenues and into another department. And I still thought that was too large based on the previous 3 years, which an average would have been about $70,000. That was an average over the last 3 years. So I went to the auditor and I asked her what the average was. What was the average transfer out over the last 3 years? About 70. And I said, wow, $100,000. Ooh, that's significantly more. Again, triple digits. And so by the time you had your first and second reading, if I had gone to council and said, I'd like you to take a look at this, then we start from reading one all over again. And because of our condensed schedule, because of Christmas and New Year's, I knew that they were going to vote on the third reading sometime that week before Christmas. I didn't know exactly the day yet. In fact, I don't know that I knew the exact day until that week, which is fine because that was dialogue that the administration was having with council. Hey, when are you going to call this last meeting? And they talked about the Monday night of that week, which would have been a committee night. And they decided no, or maybe committee was Tuesday night that week. I don't remember. So they decided on the 20th. Okay, great. So there was no time to correct the budget and start back at the first reading. There just wouldn't have been enough days in the year. We had to get this budget passed and signed before January 1. Now, at the time, we were diving head into a national crisis where the government was beginning to talk about shutdown. I certainly did not want that to happen here in our community. That's why I chose a line item veto over an outright veto. I want to make it very clear to your listeners and even to the council members at the time that I did it, that this does not impact any other of the departments. Everybody will operate and is operating normally on January 1. And frankly, I'll be honest with you, in looking at some of the other, let's call them checkbooks that the court has, because they have different funds, and a fund is much like a checkbook, there was plenty of money in those funds that if they needed some, they could go to those funds. And those funds are totally theirs. I'm hands off. I have no authority over those funds.
I think the confusion came from the people that I have talked to, and it's none of the people involved. And correct me if I'm wrong about any of this. The budget with the $177,000 for the municipal court was passed on December 20th, as you said.
Mm-hmm.
Judge Teresa Ballinger, I believe, was quoted, and this is a paraphrase of her quote,
mm-hmm.
that on December 28th, she wrote a court order, which she does every year, for the $177,000,
yep.
because she thought that was the agreed-upon amount in the budget, and that the budget had been passed on December 20th because of that. And I believe her response, she said it wasn't in response to your line item veto, but she did not know what had happened
mm-hmm.
between the budget passing, the original agreed upon amount of $177,000, and the time you line item vetoed it from $177,000 to $77,000. So let's answer the judge's question. What happened?
Well, I think I just laid that out in the timeline. We didn't realize that it was still a triple digit increase from when the safety director met with her people until the time that it was brought to my attention or recognized by me. There were a lot of things going on at the end of the year. We're tying up loose ends, and there are just a lot of things, whether it's your household, your business, or government in this case. So a lot of things were happening at that point in time. You made reference to a court order on December 28th. It's ironic that that is the exact day that I exercised a line item veto. I didn't see that court order until January 2nd. So I had no knowledge of the court order to do what she says.
So you had planned to do this when you realized it was $177,000.
Yes.
That had always been the plan.
Yes.
At any point, could there have been a conference with the judge or a conversation about, I don't think this is a good idea, I'm probably going to do something about this?
Well, again, there was, you know, they met with the safety director. And, you know, could there have been additional discussions? Certainly, I communicated with the court in the same manner that they normally communicate with me. It's nothing personal, but the judge and I parked beside each other, and we exchanged pleasantries in the morning and sometimes in the evening when we see each other. We really don't get into much more than that, to be honest with you.
I think the reason this has been a news story for 2 days in the newspaper and other places is because, and this is my understanding, and if I'm wrong, correct me, that because there was this court order and it was believed that there was going to be $177,000 coming the municipal court's way, that there now could be a legal issue between the court and the city. Is that correct?
You'd have to ask her that. I know that I exercised the power given to me by the state of Ohio and the Ohio Revised Code, and also a power that is in our codified ordinances here in the city of Marion. You know, back to the court order, you made mention that she always does a court order. I got to be honest with you, I've never seen a court order demanding the dollar amount that she requested. Now, I'm not saying she doesn't. I'm just saying as mayor and as a council member, former council member, I've never seen a judge do a court order for their budget in a fiscal budget. I've seen court orders before directing the auditor or council to do specific things with money that's already been approved in a budget. That is true. But a court order specifically saying, this is what I want my budget to be, do it or else, I've never seen that.
Is that what this has been laid out as, a do it or else?
Well, it depends how you read the order, to be quite frank with you. Look, I understand she's doing what she does as a judge, and I'm doing what I do as the executive branch of government. I think it's important for you and your listeners and anybody out there to know, this is not personal. This is public policy. It's a difference of opinion on public policy. And that's all it is. So I don't take her order as being a personal affront to me. The order was not given to me. The order was given to council.
I think what people are worried about, again, listeners are worried about, is that if she doesn't back off of the court order and you don't back off of the line item veto, that there could be legal action here, and legal action costs money, and I'm not even sure what the end result of that would be or how protracted that could be.
And that's a very good question, but you said having me back off a line item veto.
It's done. It's been exercised.
Right. The 10-day period is up where council could have overridden and chose not to. That is very telling when a council does not choose to have a special meeting to override a mayor's veto. I have vetoed things before where the council has had a special council meeting to override my veto. In fact, one summer, they did it on my planned vacation, and that is the only council meeting that I have missed in 11 years and 10 days. And it was a special meeting. So I've never missed a regularly scheduled council meeting. And you know what? I didn't hold that personal against council at the time. They had a different philosophy on a public policy issue than what I did. It's not, you can't take it personal. When you take things personal, you start creating bad public policy.
Do you feel this is personal?
No.
Okay.
So I just want to make it clear
that
it's
not personal.
No.
Right, right. Well, mm-hmm. I think the maybe what I should say then, because now you have done the line item veto, so there is no going back, as you say. Council did not overturn it.
Mm-hmm.
So here's where we are. Her court order's in place for the $177,000. And I guess we decide from here if there's going to be legal action. But I guess the backlog is the question here. Because when the $177,000 was placed on the table, I think in October is what you had said, the first time that number was put out there, first reading, somewhere in or about, and it had come down from an even higher
mm-hmm.
number,
mm-hmm.
The judge believed that that was the number, and it went through three readings. The judge believed it was the number.
Mm-hmm.
It was voted and passed on December 20th. The
yep.
judge believed that was the number. At any time during that, knowing that, as you said, you were not comfortable with that number, could there have been a, I don't like this, because a court order, as it had come every year, for a smaller amount, but every year to fund the court, would not have put us in this position? A conversation with the judge?
Well,
no.
Look, you know, the position where you're asking me to go back in time and be a mind reader, I don't know what would have happened then, okay? We have to deal with what's before us right now. And that's the most important thing, is how do we move forward? I have an open door policy as mayor. At any point in time since the line item veto, my door is open to you, any citizen listening, any elected official, any city employee. And to be frank with you, sometimes city employees drop by and sometimes residents drop by. It's always best to make sure I'm going to be there when you do it. But, you know, she could reach out at any time as well. And I do know that, you know, I suppose my legal counsel is the law director. So my law director is speaking with her. And she has said in a recent article that I don't know if it came out yesterday, today, or if it comes out tomorrow in hard copy, that, you know, she's talking to her legal counsel as well. You know, that's great. That's the way it should be done. The word is, we're talking. That's important when you're talking. When you're not talking, that's a very bad thing. So it's a good thing that the sides are talking under the circumstances, trying to figure out, as you stated a few moments ago, how do I undo a veto? Well, both sides, what I think would agree is, you don't undo a veto because it's been done. And so how do we move forward from here? And those are the things that I, again, am always open-minded to.
So at this point, aside from both sides talking to their legal counsel, nothing has changed?
Not to my knowledge, no. No. Well, except for the fact that I did ask counsel past Monday night to take that $100,000 and to deposit it in the police department's salary line item so we could hire another police officer with it. I wanted the public to know and everybody to know where that money is going to go. It's not floating around out there. It's going to good use. And so council committee has agreed to do that, again, unanimously. And we'll see what council's decision is come this Monday night, if they will vote to actually put it in the salary line item of the Marion City Police Department to hire another police officer.
If that happens and they do vote for that, and the court order does not go away from the judge, what do we just see what happens?
Too hypothetical.
Well, yeah, I think if she was going to back off of it, she would have done that by now, I would think.
You'd have to ask her.
Have you and she talked since this happened?
More than casual? I think I've answered the question my door's open.
Door's open. Okay. Yep. Well, maybe we'll talk at some point.
Parked beside her this morning. We didn't get there at the same time. Maybe when we leave at the end of the day.
There'll be a conversation.
Yeah. I mean, always willing to have conversations.
Well, it's just, I think what people are listening might be saying to themselves, if these two get together, maybe some common ground can be found here before we get into something protracted and long.
Well, I don't know. We're, again, making speculations on whether it'll be protracted and long. I don't know. Obviously, we both have the authority to do what we both have done. Strange situation that the Ohio Revised Code has given us both the authorities to do something that we've exercised to do, and they've come in maybe somewhat conflict with one another. Maybe the legislature will have to resolve that issue in the long run, but until it's resolved in the long run, we'll see what happens. I don't know.
It'll be interesting to find out. It's an interesting subject because I don't know that anything like this has happened before. To your knowledge, has anything?
Not to my knowledge. But, let's look at this as an opportunity. How often do we get to talk about the branches of government, the powers of the branches, and the checks and balances that those powers have on one another so one doesn't become more powerful than the other? We don't have that. Well, you and I have that opportunity. But how often do your listeners have the opportunity to see that? Or the readers of the local paper have an opportunity to see that? If I'm a government teacher at Marion Harding High School, this has just become a lesson for me on vetoes, checks and balances, and the powers of the branches of government. And I would take advantage of something like that. I would also look at what's going on in the national government right now if I were a history teacher or a political science teacher.
Well, it's interesting because these two things, not in issue, but in the way they are happening, are somewhat similar.
I don't know that they are similar. I exercise the power given to me by the Ohio Revised Code. The president has nothing to veto under the circumstances. So if you want to talk about the similarities,
I just think in similarity, the House and the Senate both passed a budget, mm-hmm. and the president has vetoed it, that he will not sign the budget.
But he hasn't vetoed it because it hasn't passed the Senate.
So the government is
shut down. So the Senate majority leader says, I'm not going to send it to the president because he says he'll veto it.
Right.
So the mere threat of a veto causes the U.S. Senate not to take action on something that they've already taken action on, by the way. And I think that's where there needs to be more independence from the legislative branch in the national government and the executive branch of the national government. Two different branches of government at the national level than it is with the issue that you and I have been talking about for the past 30 minutes.
So for the education, again, of the people listening locally, and if I'm wrong, let me know here, the reason you didn't bring this up before the December 20th passing of the budget with the $177,000, mm-hmm. was you feared there might be an impending government shutdown, wasn't a lot of time left, and that's why you didn't bring it up.
No, that's not it at all.
Okay, that's a good question. Why didn't you bring it up then?
Thank you for posing it as a question, not a statement.
So why during those three readings and the night it was voted,
yes.
December 20th, did you not say, I'm not in agreement with this?
Because if corrective action would have been taken by the legislative branch, it would have gone back to the first reading, and we didn't have enough time to get it done before the Christmas holiday and New Year's, which it had to be passed by then.
At the first reading, then, why did you not say something?
I don't know that I recognized it at the first reading.
Oh, okay.
I'm fairly certain, but wouldn't put my hand on a Bible and swear to it, but that doesn't seem like a time that I had noticed it.
So at this point, all we know is that people are talking to their legal counsels.
Yes, and at this point we know that my door is open for conversations.
And it, also Monday, there'll be a vote about a new police officer.
To reappropriate the $100,000 that was vetoed into the police department.
Now, was it not stated in one of these articles that the money that the judge wanted to use this for was for a probation officer?
I believe in a recent article that was stated, not in the first article that I read when the veto was first brought to the attention of the local paper. So, yes.
Is the city in need of probation officers?
You'd have to ask the judge.
Okay. So, we'll see where that goes.
Okay.
From this point. Now, with 5 minutes left, we can talk about some other things.
Okay.
Well, let me ask you this, though. Do you have any regrets in this whole thing? You can't go back and do anything, and nothing's a hypothetical, but do you think, I could have averted this in some way?
Look, I put a letter together that really outlines why I did what I did. Now, we've talked about some other things involved at the time, the timing of the readings, the timing of the triple-digit increase, but bottom line, there was an overall 70% increase of the general fund supporting the court. And that if that continues to grow at that rate, that's unsustainable. With flat revenues, I can't do that. In general terms, and I want to stress general terms, the court brings in about $850,000. Now, I'm rounding off, and they spend $1.2. So at the time, before this veto was executed, there was going to be a $370,000 of general fund money already supporting the court. And I know previous judges have always returned to the general fund the carryover or the unencumbered money, the unspent money from the previous year. And that doesn't happen anymore.
The firehouse.
Yes.
Where are we with that?
We had to go to spec and bid. We hoped that we could do an RFP, which is a request for proposals, and get that fixed. But because the dollar amount for the fix is going to be over $50,000, we have to spec it and bid it out, and that allows multiple contractors to put in a bid on it. And that went before council committee Monday night and will go before them this coming Monday night. I suspect that is something that will be suspended and we can get to that spec and bid process sooner rather than later. So we're moving on it, but the wheels of government sometimes churn slowly.
A year left on this term as mayor. Is there anything you would like to get done this coming year?
Well, certainly. I just came from a county land bank meeting this morning, and I think that the county land bank has a great opportunity to continue to do great things in this Marion County and city. But one of the things that we need to grapple with is where will future revenues come from to sustain the county land bank? Because the grant that we got, about $850,000, it's going to run out this year, and it's going to be gone. And we're not going to have the revenue to continue to do the good things the county land bank has done. So that's a concern of mine, that there doesn't seem to be much urgency to have discussions about continued revenue. It was brought up today by a citizen that the transfer tax, the $2, was supposed to be considered to go into the county land bank, and apparently it is not. Now, that is a sole decision of three county commissioners because it's a form of taxation that they initiated, and they can spend it where they want. But the idea of instituting a $2 increase with the support of the Marion County Board of Realtors and the Marion County Chamber of Commerce was that they thought it was going to go towards, or a portion of it, towards the Marion County Land Bank. And I hope that will happen because the revenue being generated going into the county land bank isn't enough to continue the good work that they have done. So I think there is the possibility that good things could continue to come from the county land bank and removing blighted properties and also rehabbing blighted properties, also working with receiverships to do the blighted properties. The city of Marion has been working with a company out of Columbus, that a receivership company, and I've talked to them twice in the past 2 weeks, or less than 2 weeks, and they said, we need more houses in the pipeline. So we as a city, because we're the only ones working with them right now, not the county land bank, we need to get more houses to them so they can evaluate whether it's worth them taking to the Court of Common Pleas to grant them receivership to fix it up. Now, this company has just received a very large, generous grant, and they would like to spend that money here in Marion County, and that's good for us when somebody wants to do that.
2019 is an election year. You will be running for re-election this year. We talked about it earlier. One Democrat has won in the last three elections in Marion County. It seems like people are going to run for mayor this time. That's a little different than in the past. We've had usually just one on the Republican side. We'll see what happens when the petitions are filed. Do you think you'll have to run a different campaign this time than you have in the past?
Well, I think you always need to be prepared to do whatever as things changed. I don't remember if we were on air or off air, but I think we were off air when we were talking about people are having fundraisers before they've even filed to run for office. So things are done differently, and you need to keep up with how those things are changing. Are they changing for the better? We're not sure of the outcome yet, so we'll be able to analyze that after Election Day, whether those changing behaviors in campaign politics were the right changes to make. But yeah, I think that you always have to be flexible to modify how you campaign and things of that nature. Look, early voting is different today than it was when I first ran for mayor. There was no early voting. You had absentee voting, but you didn't have the availability at your disposal to vote, what is it, 10 days before Election Day? Don't quote me on that, but multiple days before the actual Election Day, can you actually cast your ballot? That changes the way that we campaign today from the way it was when I was on council or when I first ran for mayor. So yes, you have to be ready to meet those changes.
Does the way the Democratic Party has fared the last 3 years give you any kind of pause?
Yes.
Yeah. So we'll see what happens.
Yes, we will.
Before we go, though, people are interested about the Board of Elections. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot about this at the end of last year, and you gave me an update, I believe, off the air.
Yep.
But I think we can give that update on the air.
Sure. With the resignation of a board member from the Democratic Party, the Democratic Central Committee came together and recommended a new appointment to the Board of Elections. It was Carolyn Weston. That recommendation from the Central and Executive Committee of the Democrats and the Republicans, I suppose, if it were a vice versa situation, goes down to the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State sent word back to Carolyn Weston, and I swore her in as a new member of the Board of Elections on, I want to say, Tuesday. And then later on this month, the Democrats will meet again to nominate a replacement for Phyllis Thomas, who has served on the Board of Elections for the Democratic Party for, I believe, two terms. So if you're listening, Phyllis, forgive me for not knowing exactly how many years it was, but I think around two terms. Phyllis has done a great job. Always a lot of challenges in appointed positions like that, but she has chosen not to seek reappointment. So that's why the Democratic Party will choose her replacement later on this month, and then we'll go through the process of, again, of getting that person officially sworn in and approved by the Secretary of State. And so the Democrats will have two new board members on the Board of Elections. And then they'll start to, I presume, unless they've already started, to look to replace and I'll get the term wrong, assistant executive director, I think, who also was let go by the previous board.
Deputy director.
Thank you. Yeah.
I'll tip my tongue. 60 seconds left to go for this year. Yourself and the other Democrats that'll be running, in your opinion, what do they have to do to be more successful than they have been the last 3 years locally?
Well, you have to understand your voters. I think that's the most important thing. If you don't understand the voters in which you are seeking to hold office, then your voters, they won't vote for you. So you have to know them, you have to understand them, and you have to be approachable by them, and they have to be able to be comfortable with you as their elected official.
And you'll be dancing on the 16th?
Yeah.
At the Women's Club?
Completely out of character for me, ladies and gentlemen, but I am doing a call to dance for a fundraiser for the Women's Club Home on the 16th of February.
16th of February, and 5 to 9.
I'm doing what they call the Foxtrot, and I've never ballroom danced before, and I only have the first three steps and a spin down.
Oh, so this will be good.
I don't know how many steps there are in a foxtrot, but I've only got the first three in a spin.
If you want to see the Mayor Foxtrot, it's $75, February 16th at the Women's Club Home.
And that money does go to the Women's Club Home.
Absolutely. To help with the boiler system, which is over 100 years old.
Oh, boy.
From what I hear.
Yeah.
It's an older system.
Speaking of 100 years, back to the firehouse.
There you go.
Yep.
Thank you, Mayor.
Thanks for having me on.
We'll be back tomorrow with more programming. Stay tuned. There's more right around the corner here on WWGH Radio.
Magnificent Marian Moments on WWGH Radio.